I see we have full capacity in here, and I think there were a couple people outside that wanted to sit in. If there are any attorneys at law that are seated in the galley at all, you may enter the well and sit on the bench along the back of here. It's my understanding that we also have overflow seating set up so that there should be room for, as we'll try to make sure that we have room for as many people as possible to watch the proceedings. And counsel for the parties may enter the well. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our second case on our oral calendar today is case number A19-1275, In re the matter of the welfare of the child of ARH, RWG, and MLR. Counsel, I see there are several counsel seated at the counsel's table. I just want to confirm, will any of the parties be splitting time?
We will not, Your Honor.
Okay. Counsel for respondent? Okay. Thank you very much. Counsel for appellants, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments. Respondents also will have 15 minutes, and then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you so choose, the podium can be adjusted up and down. There's a button right underneath. And counsel for each, when you start, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, your honors, counsel. Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Slama. I'm a certified student attorney representing the appellant, Grandma, and I'm supervised here today by Professor Natalie Netzel. We ask this court to allow this child to be adopted by its grandma. It was an error, an abuse of discretion, and contrary to the child's best interest to not place it with grandma. She is a licensed foster care provider. Therefore, Grandma respectfully requests this court reverse the district court decision. In this case, we have the child's own grandmother. She is a part of his same culture, race, family, and he has known her since the day that he was born. She is committed, competent, loving, and all around a wonderful person who desperately desires to adopt her grandson. Most counties would jump at the opportunity to place this child with family. Instead, this child has been placed with white foster care providers. These foster care providers are not kin, and before this case began, were strangers to this family. The Minnesota legislature clearly prioritizes family and culture in adoption proceedings. The law provides that whenever possible, children should be placed with family members who are part of their own culture. This is a case about an intransigent county administration undermining legislative policy. Worse yet,
Are you attacking the agency decision or the district court decision?
Both, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, counsel, I'd appreciate it if you would focus on what point. And unfortunately, this case does have an extended history. And of course, we all recognize, as argued, I think, in both briefs, the importance of stability in placement and in permanency in placement for a child. So when you refer to the county and perhaps the district court undermining that policy, at what point in time during the case are you referring to? I heard you in your opening statement refer to the point at which the grandmother obtained a foster license. So is that the point at which you think the district court and/or the county should have taken steps to place this child with the grandmother?
Your Honor, that's a difficult question because the county and the court in this case never meaningfully considered this grandma. There were multiple times within this case that she should have been considered. For example, the child could have been placed with her immediately when it was removed from its parents' care.
Well, the findings from the district court are that immediate emergency placement with the grandmother wasn't possible because the father, at least initially, disputed paternity. Now, I appreciate, you know, that the record lays this out. Those are very close timelines, as in matters of days for the DNA test to return. But, of course, this child was getting discharged from the hospital. They needed an emergency placement. So at that time, for that one reason, and there are others given by the district court, emergency placement with the grandmother wasn't possible.
Your Honor, to that point, I would say that the best time from a legal perspective to look at when the county was unreasonable and failing to place with this grandma was at the time that she intervened for placement. That was
occurred when?
December 5th, 2017. And at that time, the court needed to make a prima facie showing about whether the county was unreasonable in failing to place with her.
But she didn't become foster care certified until August of 2017, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That precedes her motion, right?
Correct. But
That is after the child had already been placed in foster care on April 1st of 2017, when a decision had to be made very quickly, we need to place this child somewhere.
Correct.
Okay.
But at that time that she intervened, the child could have been placed with her. Children can reside with relatives without a license as long as the home is licensable. And the fact that Grandma is today licensed demonstrates that she was licensable at that time.
So was she? But she wasn't licensed until August of 2007. She wasn't licensed in April.
She was not licensed at that time, no.
Okay.
She was pursuing the licensing.
Okay. But the foster parents were licensed at that time?
Correct.
Okay. And the foster parents have taking care of a number of other children as well.
They have, Your Honor, yes.
So there's no dispute that they were capable, certified, willing, and able to care for this child?
No, Your Honor. In this case, we have two very qualified people. We have a grandma who has a foster care license, is tied to this child by culture, by blood, by family, and you have foster providers who have cared for many children and by all accounts are great foster care providers. No one is disputing that. What's different here is that the delay in proceedings, the court's decision to legally delay proceedings and not hear grandma's motion, and then to base its decision to keep the child with the foster care providers, created an attachment to this child.
Right, but don't we have, this case is a little different than a normal one where you might have two parties asking at the same time to take care of the child. Here you had the parents that the county instituted a TPR, termination of parental rights proceedings against them, a case where they argued against it. It came up to this court, to the Court of Appeals.
Yep.
The Court of Appeals reversed and for further proceedings,
correct,
for further detailed findings. The district court had to look at that, take that under consideration. So it seems to me that based on the record that the district court said, well, we don't know if this TPR, the TPR has already been reversed once. I don't know if I'm going to get reversed again. I think it's better to wait to determine whether or not, this is probably going to get appealed again, whether or not the TPR actually stands or not. Because if the TPR doesn't stand, the child will go back with one or both of the parents.
Correct, Your Honor.
So there's a wrinkle here of, where is this child actually going to go? And we don't want to be moving the child all over. One of the overriding things that need to be considered by the court is stability of the child. That's an overarching concern for any child.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is a district court under these particular facts, why is it abuse of the court's discretion to wait until the district court finds out what actually is going to happen with respect to a termination of parental rights issue that's already has already been reversed once?
Your Honor, why it was error in this case is not because the child wasn't moved at that time. The error lies in when the decision-making process took place. What the court could have done is decided a long time ago what would happen for this child in the case of TPR. Then the county could have worked to increase visitation, communicate with this child what the plan was for its life, and prepare to make that transition smooth in the case that a TPR did take place. That's why our laws require that permanency decisions are made at the earliest possible time and that concurrency planning takes place. It's to have a safety net in place. In this case, there was no safety net. This kid was left in limbo, not knowing what way it was going to go. The fact that the court delayed for 19 months...
Well, the child was left in limbo, in the legal limbo, not in physical limbo, because the child was with foster parents during this whole time, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And, I'm sorry, you had a question?
Go ahead.
And grandmother did have right to see the child, was seeing the child during that time as well.
Correct. She was seeing it twice a week.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm trying to get some clarity from you when the error is that you're pointing to. I understand the argument about how delaying the ultimate evidentiary hearing kind of compounds the earlier decision of both the agency and the court. So what is the error that you're pointing to? Because there are rules that apply to whether or not a court is exercising its discretion in holding those evidentiary hearings. It doesn't make a lot of logical sense to have an evidentiary permanency hearing when the TPR is still on appeal. So putting that aside, the error that you're pointing to from the district court, are you saying it was just at the initial stage?
Your Honor, the error that we're pointing to is the district court's inability to make a decision regarding permanency for this child and the delay of the evidentiary hearing on permanent placement for 19 months. Once the pre-adoptive agreement was signed with the foster parents and grandma had intervened for placement, there should have been an evidentiary hearing at that time determining what was in the child's best interests. At that time, the best interest analysis would have resolved around what truly was in the child's best interest, not being tainted and compounded by this delay and this attachment that formed due to the court's legal error.
But the court, would you agree, would not be able to finalize that adoption?
Correct, Your Honor. The statute clearly says that. But it also says that permanency decisions are made at the earliest possible time. The reason that that is important is because our laws and our policies favor family and culture. If in every case the district court was allowed to delay making any permanency decision until TPR was finalized and then say, we can't move this child because it's attached, it undermines that legislative policy.
No, I understand the argument, but, I mean, you're balancing the parents' rights as well, and they have a right to appeal the TPR and to challenge whether there was error in the TPR. So it almost sounds like the error is in this kind of contingency planning or the concurrent planning that you're pointing to. But it may be that maybe I'm misunderstanding kind of your argument.
Your Honor, the parents absolutely had a right to appeal their termination of parental rights. They have a right to understand why their rights were being terminated. That's why this case has been on an appeal three times. But that doesn't mean that this child should be denied the opportunity to be raised by its family. And so what the court could have done is make that decision on where this child goes in the case that TPR is finalized when it was supposed to based on timelines.
So, again, they're having review hearings, right, while the appeal's pending?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so it sounds like you're saying the error below was during those review hearings, the district court not doing something in terms of placement and visitation to expand a potential permanent option with grandmother.
Your Honor.
As opposed to saying that they were wrong at the prima facie stage or that they were wrong to in its discretion to wait because the statute says you can't finalize adoption. It sounds like you're really saying that in those intervening review periods, the court made and the agency didn't support grandmother's interests enough.
No, Your Honor. The statute, Minnesota Statute 260C-607 Subdivision 1C, unambiguously says that all progress continues during the pendency of an appeal, except for that it's not finalized.
Progress for
towards adoption. And Minnesota Statute, the Subdivision 6 under that same chapter, is the review hearing or the evidentiary hearing that grandma asked for. That is an example of all progress. Essentially, what should have happened is permanency decisions for this child should have been made and teed up so that in the case of a TPR, this child knew where he was going and everybody was ready to execute that. By delaying that decision...
So, counsel, if I can just ask one more time, and I apologize if it sounds like I've asked you this before, but is it your position that this district court should have held the evidentiary hearing while the TPR appeal was pending?
Absolutely, Your Honor,
okay,
yes.
I thought that was your position. I just wanted to make sure it was clarified. So you aren't focused on the review hearings?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And there's not a point in time in which you're telling us that the district court simply should have altered placement of the child?
No, Your Honor, not on 260C.
I'm differentiating that from the adoption decision.
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. In all child protection proceedings, the best interests of the child are paramount. In this case, this child's best interests were not served by this illegal delay. He, as we've said, permanency could have been established for him, and he could have had the right to be raised with his family. Instead, he's separated from his people, from his kin, from his traditions, simply because of an attachment that formed over a long period of time.
Well, your argument presupposes that he's having no contact with his family, his biological family at all, but that's not true, is it, counsel?
No, Your Honor. This child is also attached to his grandma, and that's been well documented by experts in this case.
And you even said he's seen grandmother at least twice a week.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not like he's not having any contact whatsoever with his biological family.
No, he is seeing his grandmother.
So what should this court make of the determination or the review, the assessment that was done in June 2018, I think by Ms. McMahon, saying that the visitation with grandmother was punitive?
Your Honor, I think...
How does that influence our review of this record?
Correct. I think that assessment is very important to keep in mind throughout the big picture of this case. First of all, the first assessment said this child should be with grandma. He's not seeing her enough. He needs to be transitioned to her care immediately over the course of 6 weeks. By the time this court actually heard this evidentiary hearing, the expert in this case said, I don't know what you do now. Culture is super important, but this child has been placed with these people for almost 3 years. He's attached to them. She never said leave him with the foster parents, but she said you've created a difficult situation.
I think what you're alluding to is that Ms. McMahon, at the time of the evidentiary hearing, had actually changed her opinion and gave no recommendation about a change in adoption placement. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that shows just exactly how prejudicial this delay was.
Well, it does show, from your standpoint, how prejudicial the delay was, but it also highlights for this court that it really is your position that the evidentiary hearing had to occur while the TPR appeal was pending is the crucial turning point. Seems to be the nugget of your position that this court would have to adopt.
Yes,
I guess I'm struggling to see on what authority would we do that, especially under an abuse of discretion standard of review. And I didn't mean to throw that at you right at the end of your time. It certainly you do have, as the presiding judge will tell you, you've got 5 minutes for your rebuttal, so you can give that some thought and return to that topic.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Janine Putnam. I represent respondent Chisago County Health and Human Services in this matter. I'd like to open with just a general statement regarding the standard of review in this matter. All of the errors raised and alleged in appellant's brief are reviewed for an abuse of discretion. It's the agency's position here that the district court did not abuse its discretion in any of its determinations and that the panel should affirm the order.
So you're well aware, counsel, that an abuse of discretion does include the situation where a district court does not follow the law.
Correct.
And, of course, it's the position of the appellant that this district court didn't because all progress was not made toward permanency while the TPR appeal was pending.
And I do understand that.
As was argued that the evidentiary hearing should have occurred, if not during the time of the TPR appeal, then immediately after it was over. And instead, there was a, say, 4 to 5 month delay after the TPR appeal was over.
And I would note for the panel that there is a mechanism for reviewing adoptive placement outside of 260C.607 subdivision 6, and that is found in subdivision 5, paren B. I would argue that the district court did timely address appellant's motions. Appellant filed her first motion on December 5th, 2017. That motion did request placement of the child. The court addressed that on January 5th, 2018, 1 month after the motion was filed.
Right, but on January 5th, the district court stayed the appellant's motion.
Correct, and I would draw Your Honor's attention to the language in both Subdivision 5B and Subdivision 6 paren C. And that's discretionary language, which indicates that the court may order the agency to take the requested action. So there was nothing in Subdivision 5 paren B that required the district court
I understand that. It doesn't say shall. It says may.
Correct.
But that doesn't mean that district court can't abuse its discretion by staying it when you're looking at the paramount interest of reuniting children, keeping children with their family members.
Correct.
And you've got important issues here of keeping them with the family. This is a grandmother who saw the child right from day one, was there when the child was born, has had constant contact with the child, understands the grandmother's biracial. This is a biracial child who understands completely what this child is going to be going through in the child's life. And that overriding concern of keeping children with their family, with their culture, with their history, why isn't it an abuse of discretion then for the district court to not say, you know what, we need to make this decision now, I'm not going to put it off, I need to make this decision now?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that the considerations you're mentioning, as well as other considerations before the district court at the time of each of these three motions, really come down to the best interests of the child. I'm certainly not trying to diminish the importance of family relationships, of cultural ties. However, the district court was tasked with considering things like the child's current relationship with caretakers.
Right, but when you're talking about this motion in December, the child was born March 28th of 2016. I mean, this is still fairly early on in the child's life.
It is early on in the child's life, Your Honor, but it is.
And I should add that she had been certified, foster care certified by that time as well.
She had, Your Honor.
So there's no question that she can take care of the child.
There's no question that the child could have been placed in her home at that point.
And
that's
grandmother's
correct.
18-year-old child as well was more than willing to help out as well. So you've got a good setting for this child, right?
Your Honor, you have a safe home that is capable of taking care of the child. As appellant noted, nobody is arguing that either of these homes are unsafe or inappropriate for children. This child's very lucky to have both of these options. However, what you are talking about, even in December of 2017, is severing a primary attachment. And so even if the child was moved to the grandmother's home, whether or not the child was ultimately ordered to be reunified with the parents, we're talking about severing that primary attachment.
Correct, but you're talking about severing attachment with, you're not talking about severing the attachment to place a child with a complete stranger and have to start from ground zero. This is a person, a grandmother, who has seen the child already two times a week, which is, so it's not an insignificant amount of time.
That's true, Your Honor, and I think that the record lays that out pretty clearly. The record also shows the testimony of many mental health professionals. I believe three or four testified in this matter, and they all testified that regardless of where this child was moved, this was going to be a trauma. It was going to sever a primary attachment. It was going to be a difficult adjustment. Additionally, this child has special needs, which were also considered by the district court. He suffers from an anxiety disorder. He shows a lack of resiliency that is atypical for a child of his age. So all signs point to a move for this child being more difficult than it may be for other children.
So the argument that appellant's counsel makes in response to that, counsel, is that you're referring to expert testimony that was given during the evidentiary hearing, which is long after the December 2017 motion that grandmother filed to seek placement with her. So that it's really by your focus, by the county and the district court's focus on the primary attachment with the foster family, as wonderful as that has been for the child, it has essentially created a de facto uprooting of a preference then to the foster family placement instead of to relative placement, which there is certainly statutory support for Minnesota's preference for a relative placement, which would go to grandmother.
Your Honor, so I wouldn't know.
That delay is really troublesome, and I haven't heard you confront that, you know, what the appellants describe as a 19-month delay. So if you would do that, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As an initial point, I would note that as early as April 2017, a mental health professional had observed the attachment between the child and the foster mother.
In April of 2017?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor. So
And I don't think anybody's denying the attachment.
I understand, Your Honor.
Or, you know, it really is a question of multiple attachments, right? And your evidence, as well as the evidence offered by the appellants, recognizes that a child can have multiple attachments.
It does, Your Honor, but it also recognizes that a child is only capable of one primary attachment. And that primary attachment is much more significant with regard to impact on the child's development.
And I have read the testimony. It is very compelling, which, again, is why I would like you to address the 19-month or however you want to characterize it, but the delay between grandmother's motion in December 2017 and the final evidentiary hearing and resolution by the district court.
Well, and Your Honor, as I began to note previously, the first two motions were addressed by the district court.
Well, counsel, I'm not satisfied with that answer because the district court addressed them only to put them on hold.
But the district court also addressed issues of visitation, of ongoing contact. During each of those hearings, a transition.
What was the district court's reasoning? And again, maybe I'm still focused on this interim stage and not so much the way it's been framed by appellant, because it seems to me that the district court has this opportunity during the 19 months while you're waiting for the TPR appeal to happen. The court has the review hearings. The progress towards permanency rests in the court's and the agency's hands during that period of time. So what was the court's reasoning in initially addressing, as you put it, addressing the motion through its authority on an interim basis regarding visitation and placement? What was the reasoning for not expanding beyond just 2 days or not looking at more overnights or during that period of time? What was the court's basis for addressing the request from grandmother the way it did?
Your Honor, depending on the time of the review hearing, there were a number of considerations.
Let's start with the first one after the motion was filed, when you say they addressed that motion at the early stage.
Sure. So at the January 5th hearing, when that first motion is addressed and visitation is expanded, but placement or guardianship is denied, at that time there had been contact between the child and the grandparent, but that contact had never been unsupervised, and it had largely been in the presence of the child's father. And so visitation started to occur on a more regular basis between just the grandparent and the child. Throughout the subsequent hearings, the length of those visitations, the frequency of that visitation was expanded. The visitation was eventually moved from supervised to unsupervised in the grandmother's home. There was not a move to overnight visitation, but by time that sort of visitation was being considered and maybe appropriate for the child was already experiencing these behaviors associated with transitions into unsupervised time.
And did the district court note any concerns about grandmother, apart from that she had not had unsupervised contact?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there were any safety concerns raised regarding the grandmother's home. The focus was entirely on this child's adjustment. And by the time unsupervised visitation was occurring, this child had a therapist who was not recommending overnight visitation. The agency does the best it can to determine the best interests of children, but ultimately social workers are not mental health providers. And in this case, the mental health provider was indicating that overnight visitation was not appropriate for the child at this stage. So the district court did consider all of these things. The district court also considered the position of the guardian ad litem in making these decisions. So these matters were addressed, despite the fact that the court declined to order a final adoptive placement in either home.
I want to come back to that. I want to specifically to Judge Bradfield's question. I understand you point to the district court's rationale for its delay. I want to hear from you, though, why, what is the justification for the district court's delay in not making a decision earlier on?
Your Honor, I believe the district court wasn't required to make that decision.
I understand
earlier on.
The district court wasn't required. But I want to understand. I'm not hearing a good answer as to why the district court did that.
I think I understand what you're asking, Your Honor. And I think ultimately the answer to that question is the district court was not willing to move the child and therefore chose not to order a final adoptive placement.
But why not move the child to a family member? If the TPR was reversed, the child would go back to the parents. So it would still be in line with the family.
Your Honor, if the TPR were reversed with regard to the father, that's true. If the TPR were reversed with regard to the mother, that matter becomes a lot more complicated. The mother had indicated throughout the proceedings that she did not want the child to be placed in the grandmother's home. So if that had been the case, if that had transpired, what would have occurred is there would have been a child residing in a relative placement that had this sort of acrimonious relationship with the parent that reunification was now required with. So not only do you have a child's primary attachment severed and he's adjusting to a new home, but now he's adjusting to moving back into the care of a parent with all of this, you know, additional tension, these additional restrictions and inability for the mother at some points to even be present with the grandmother due to the history of restraining orders in this case.
But why isn't an abuse of discretion for the district court realizing that it's delaying because the child may be moved again, and the overall concern from everybody is the welfare of the child, but the district court is saying, well, the child might be moved back to the parents, so I don't want to move the child right now. But there's a possibility that if the TPR does go through, the child's going to need permanency. Why not have that permanency with a family member?
Your Honor, I think that's the issue that was ultimately addressed by the court. And at the end of the day, the district court concluded that it was not in this child's best interest to be moved. I think it all comes down to the district court's best interest determination, which was made throughout this 19 months. At every review hearing, the district court was asked whether it was in the best interest of the child to stay where he was or to be moved. And at every stage...
Or to expand grandmother's time.
Correct. And at every stage, the court decided yes or no to expand visitation, how to expand visitation, whose opinion it found most compelling, and ultimately to decline to move the child.
Doesn't it become a fait accompli if the district court ends up delaying, and then at the end says, well, you know, really should stay with the foster parents because the child's been with the foster parents. Aren't we setting a bad precedent by taking that approach and approving that type of decision or non-decision by district court?
Your Honor, I understand that argument, but I would note that if this motion had been heard in December of 2017, there's no indication on the record that the district court would have reached a different conclusion. The child was already attached to the primary caregiver. All of these things that are present at the time of the ultimate evidentiary hearing were present in December.
Can I ask it differently?
Yes.
Is there any mechanism for the grandmother to seek review of a district court's decision in the interim stage, let's say in January, on January 5th, or the next 90-day hearing, at that stage, to hear from the guardian, to hear from the mental health workers, as you're explaining, and for the district court to at that time say, we're not going to expand from supervised to unsupervised with grandmother just yet, we're not going to give overnights just yet. Is there some mechanism to review those interim decisions? Because I do think what is concerning is the way that the interim decisions kind of compound and become the driving force at the time there finally is a hearing. We're concerned about stability, the stability that was built during those review hearings. So what mechanism would there be to review a decision not to, for example, lift the supervision requirement or not to give overnights?
Your Honor, I think that the mechanism there would be after the child was placed in the guardianship of the commissioner for appellant to have filed that formal motion for adoptive placement with those supporting attachments, which triggers the requirement for an evidentiary hearing. In this case, these motions were filed. The prima facie showing wasn't made. The district court wasn't required to hold that evidentiary hearing. I would absolutely agree that under Subdivision 6, an evidentiary hearing is required, but under Subdivision 5, paren B, it's not. So I do think there is a mechanism. I would also note that at any time leading up to the termination of parental rights, the grandmother could have applied for a foster care license. You know, there's dispute in the testimony about why that occurred, but at the end of the day, the district court concluded that the case manager and her contemporaneous documentation regarding that year's worth of conversations with the grandmother were more credible than the version presented by appellant at trial. And so there were a lot of things that could have gone differently in this case that would have resulted in the child either not having as significant of an attachment to the foster family or the foster family not being a permanency option. The foster family didn't commit to adopting this child until after the termination petition was filed. So up until that time, the county didn't have an option but to try to move this child to a permanent home. At the time that appellant filed her motion, we have a child who has special needs, who is securely attached on an appropriate developmental track, and suddenly we're considering completely uprooting him during the, oh, I apologize, Your Honor, I didn't notice the light, uprooting him and moving him with the risk of that appeal outstanding. Unless the panel has any other questions, I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant.
Your Honors, briefly, Judge Bratfold, if I could address your question. Minnesota Statute 260C607 Subdivision 1C requires that all progress must continue during the pendency of an appeal. It doesn't mean some progress. It doesn't mean we have review hearings and we pick and choose what we do. It means everything. Subdivision 6, the review hearing that Grandma asked for, is required under that, and not holding that hearing is an abuse of discretion. Judge Reyes, to your question about moving this child and bouncing around from foster homes and maybe to the grandma, I agree. This child should have been placed with family. However, if the judge's concern was having multiple placements, what it could have very well done is conducted the decision-making process on this case much earlier and set up what would happen that in the case of a TPR, this child goes to grandma. Having that built into place was something that could have happened. The decision-making process should have happened. The court would have had discretion when to move that child.
Right, but the standard review here is abuse of discretion of what the district court is going to decide. And we, as an error-correcting court, we're not in the position of second-guessing what the district court did. The issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion by either committing an error of law or made a decision not based on the factual record. So if this is something that's left to the discretion of the district court, we usually don't question that at all. And here, it's obviously a very, very difficult decision that the district court had as to, in some ways, almost a better decision than what sometimes we have and we see, where here you had two sets of people that loved and cared for and wanted to take care of this child. As the district court even acknowledged, this is an extremely difficult decision. But those types of decisions, we generally don't second guess.
Yes, Your Honor, not the decision of when to move the child. However, the decision-making process was mandated by statute. That having that hearing was mandated under...
Which hearing? The evidentiary hearing or review hearings?
Both, Your Honor. The review hearings are, of course, required to happen every 90 days. The evidentiary hearing on adoptive placement under 260C607 Subdivision 6 is part of the progress that must continue during the pendency of an appeal. That was required to be held as well.
So, counsel, respondents, counsel argued that in that January, I believe, 2018 hearing following the grandmother's motion for change in placement and adoption, that the district court denied change in placement and increased visitation. So would you address that?
Yes,
it seems as though that is consistent with your view of what should have happened, that the district court should have laid groundwork for a possible ultimate decision for adoption and did so by increasing visitation.
Your Honor, I think it's important to note that from November 2017 until January 2018, the county and the district court stopped visitation between the grandmother and this child. That was around the time of the TPR. Grandma had to intervene in this matter and request visitation.
So November 2017 until?
until January of 2018.
Right, and that's what we're talking about, is January 2018, the district court then set in place some additional visitation. And you can describe it however you want. You know the record better than I do. But the point is that after the grandmother's motion, the district court did take action and increase, alter visitation in favor of grandmother.
Yes, Your Honor, and having more visitation between this child and the grandmother was wonderful, but that's not what our law specifically requires. What we're arguing is that Subdivision 6 was something that must happen during the pendency of an appeal, and it didn't take place. And because it didn't take place, the best interest factors and the analysis that took place in this case was tainted and must be redone.
So I think the way I understand that the child protection cases is there's different phases. The first phase about adjudication, the second phase about termination, and then the third phase on permanency. You could have evidentiary hearings at each of those three main stages with review hearings in between. So it sounds like what you're arguing for is a rule that would, after today, or after this opinion, if we agree with your view of the law, would require district courts to have that third evidentiary hearing in every case, even though the TPR is still being appealed.
Your Honor, what we're asking for is that this court issue an opinion that says that, consistent with 260C, 607, Subdivision 1C, all progress must continue. And a part of that progress is the evidentiary hearing.
Right, so you're saying that they would have that third evidentiary hearing even though the second one is under appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. This decision below is deeply troubling. It perpetuates the worst history of this state's adoption and child protection systems. This court should issue an opinion making clear that district courts must follow modern legislative directives, that they cannot illegally delay hearings, and that family and culture is prioritized in Minnesota. With that, Grandma respectfully requests that this court reverse the district court decision and allow her to adopt her grandson. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. And Ms. Lano, is this your first argument before the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, it was my second.
Okay. Well, I think that the future of appellate advocacy is in very good hands.
Thank you.
Very well done. Very well done by both parties and very well briefed. We realize that this is a very important issue, and we will be taking the matter under consideration and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you all.